The gospel reading today is from Luke chapter 13. And I think Dr. Woodyard might have preached on this passage just earlier in the year. So, well, Doc Woodyard went off lectionary. So you get to hear a second message from this lectionary text this year. This is the passage where Jesus heals a crippled woman. Now, Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. The key phrase there is, on the Sabbath. And just then, there appeared a woman with a spirit that had crippled her for 18 years. She was bent over and quite unable to stand up straight. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are free from your ailment." And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she stood up straight and began praising God. The leader of that synagogue, indignant because Jesus had cured on the Sabbath, kept saying to the crowd, "Now there are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be cured if you want, but not on the Sabbath day." And Jesus answered him and said, "You hypocrite, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his own ox or his own donkey from the manger and lead it away to give it some water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan had bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on this Sabbath day?" And when he said this, all his opponents were put to shame, and the entire crowd was rejoicing at the wondrous things he was doing. Well, this week I was prompted to remember an old name of a theologian I had appreciated a lot in earlier years, and that's Miroslav Volf, who's a Croatian theologian. Actually, he's a Pentecostal, raised Pentecostal during the Soviet regime in Croatia and Yugoslavia at that time. It was called Yugoslavia. And so imagine what it would have been like growing up Pentecostal in Soviet Yugoslavia. His father was a Pentecostal preacher and was suppressed and was hounded by the government the entire time that Miroslav was being raised. And Miroslav Volf ended up being a very famous Protestant theologian who taught not only at the Zagreb Seminary but also at Fuller Theological Seminary, and now holds a post at Yale Divinity School. For the first 35 to 40 years of his life, though, he worked in the Soviet context in which religion really was not allowed. You weren't allowed to be religious. And it's interesting how he thinks about religion, having come from that context. He wrote two very powerful books, and especially in the context of the Yugoslav conflict, because, as we know, Yugoslavia, the nations that were forced together to become Yugoslavia are made up of different peoples. And so we have this ethnic violence that had erupted in what was formerly Yugoslavia. So it's out of this context that he's arising and working. He's written very powerful books about reconciliation, about personal reconciliation and about political reconciliation. One of the books that was probably the most famous was called Exclusion and Embrace. It was written in 1996, and Christianity Today, even though it's a really conservative Christian magazine, called it one of the 100 best theological books of the century. And in that book, he said something really interesting about liberation theology. He said, "I love liberation theology, but if any kind of liberation theology creates people who are the oppressors and people who are the oppressed, and never gets back to embrace, then it has gone off mark." So the goal is not freedom from the oppressed and the oppressor, and to keep the oppressor for the rest of your life, but the goal is embrace. Exclusion and Embrace was the name of this book. He also wrote a book 10 years later called The End of Memory, in which he claims that memories concerned merely with the truth of what had happened and oriented exclusively towards justice can often become untruthful for us and unjust memories. And with a very powerful phrase, he says, the shield of memory often morphs into a sword. Again, he's saying, we got to get back to embrace and healing. That's what's the most important thing. And in 2003, Miroslav Volf founded the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. And it's interesting how if you see the work, look at the work of that institute, throughout his life, he's consistently been interested in why religions thrive and why they don't. And this, you could see how, growing up in Soviet context, that'd be a really interesting question. How come religions have thrived after the Soviet Empire was dismantled? One of the study groups is called God and Human Flourishing. That's part of that center. And in that study group, they ask the question, what is it about the ultimate concerns of all the great faith traditions that continue to seem compelling and important to people? And conversely, what is it about certain kinds of religion that make those religions uncompelling or inimical to people? And he says this, and I had found this quote. This is what actually brought back to mind Miroslav Volf. I found this quote on the blog of a friend, and Julie Mulroy, in unbelievably speedy time, found the original citation for this. But from an essay called Reflections on a Christian Way of Being in the World, Miroslav Volf writes this: there is something profoundly hypocritical about praising God for God's mighty deeds of salvation and cooperating at the same time with the demons of destruction, whether by neglecting to do good or by actively doing evil. Without speaking the truth and without action in the world, the adoration of God is empty and hypocritical, always degenerating into irresponsibility and quietism. I'm going to read that last phrase again because it's really interesting. Without speaking the truth and without action in the world, the adoration of God is empty and hypocritical, degenerating into irresponsibility and quietism. So when are our religious institutions and traditions compelling and healing? When do they tend towards human flourishing? Well, Volf says it's when they speak the truth and when they act for justice in the world. And how do you wreck a religion then? How do you make it void of meaning and compelling vision? What are the marks of a religious institution or tradition that is dead or dying? And what are the marks of a religious institution or tradition that does not contribute to human growth and flourishing? And he says this: when it does not speak the truth, and when it does not act for justice in the world, it's dead. And today's text is a really neat example of that, isn't it? Jesus comes into the temple in the synagogue on a Sabbath day. It's the day for worship. But it's also the day of rest. And here's a woman who's been crippled for 18 years and comes seeking healing. And Jesus says to her, come unto me, and heals the woman. And what does the person in the synagogue say? Wait a minute, you can't do that. It's not part of our rules and regulations here. We don't do work on the Sabbath day, you know, and healing somebody is work. So, you know, if you want to be cured, people, if you want to be cured of your illnesses and stuff, go do that on the other 6 days of the week when that's legal. But it's not legal to be doing this on Saturday, on the Sabbath day. And Jesus says to him, you hypocrite, right? You have forgotten what's important, haven't you? Haven't you forgotten what's important? It's interesting that ancient hearers of this story sometimes wouldn't be hung up on the things that modern hearers of the story are hung up on. Modern hearers of this story, if they're not church people, will often say, well, this is just proof that the Bible's a bunch of hooey. Here, Jesus healing somebody. You know, Jesus didn't have any power to heal somebody. This is all mythology. And I understand when people talk that way, but we have to understand, too, that that's a modern objection to an ancient text. In the ancient context, 2,000 years ago, in which Jesus lived, it was taken for granted that there were people who had the powers to heal other people. It was part of the medical system. You know, if you were sick, you went to a healer. You didn't go to a hospital and get diagnosed with an MRI. And so the main point for these people, if ancient people were reading this story, they would not be hung up on the fact that Jesus healed this woman. they would have taken it for granted. There were people who had shamanistic sort of abilities who could channel the divine and could heal people. They would have understood that the main point of the story would have been the main point of the story. That the objection of the religious person to the healing is the main point of the story. Can you believe that this religious person, this person who's supposed to be the spokesperson for God, objects to the woman being healed? Can you believe that? And so, when we look at this story, it invites all sorts of kind of ideas, doesn't it? It invites us to think about dead and dying religions. How do you wreck a religion? What's the short course in how to wreck a religion? Well, according to Wolf, he says this: you shift your focus. Where you used to be willing to speak the truth, you don't. And where you used to be willing to do justice and engage in God's healing activity in the world, you find all sorts of excuses not to do that. And once you do that, you've wrecked your religion. How do you wreck a religion? You start majoring on the minors and minoring on the majors. You take the baby and the bathwater and you go, whoo-woo-woo, and pitch them both out at the same time. That's how you wreck a religion. To stop speaking the truth and to stop doing justice and doing God's work of healing in the world. So the question for us today as we make a survey of our particular religious landscape in which we live is this: are we surrounded by healthy and healing religious communities which are speaking the truth and which are pursuing justice and right relationship amongst all people? Or do we look around and see, frankly, a good deal of pretty unhealthy religion? Sidetracked religion, wrecked religion, religious institutions and traditions in which more time and energy is spent on making sure people dot their I's and cross their T's in regards to what Jesus himself called the lesser matters of the law, and then spend far too little time pursuing what Jesus himself called the greater matters of the law. In the words of Micah, to do justice, to act humbly with God, to seek mercy, to be merciful. When we were out in Montana, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that we were driving on vacation, we were driving through these little small towns, and we saw a number of churches that had the exact same sign out in front. It must have been a person who was making these signs and was selling them to churches because they were designed exactly the same. And the churches, these signs said, God's Ten Commandments. And it listed the Ten Commandments from Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 20. And, you know, as I was going through and I see every one of, there's probably five or six different churches that had this exact same sign in the same county. I thought, this is really interesting. But it sort of tells you something about American religion sometimes, doesn't it? Not that I think that there's anything wrong with the Ten Commandments, other than the fact that they are 3,000 years old, and we would want to edit a couple of them to make sure that, you know, we don't believe in slavery and don't believe that women are owned by their husbands. But other than that, they're not a bad set of basic rules by which to live our lives, engage whether we're doing what's right or wrong. But really, is that the point of religion? Is the point of religion putting a big sign up in front of your church saying, don't do this, so that you won't wreck your life, your personal life? It makes me wonder if the main idea has been forgotten. Is really the point of religion to make sure people don't do certain things we think are disruptive in their personal lives? Or is the main point of religion to speak the truth and to pursue the justice God intends for the world? And to pursue the healing God intends for the whole world? It's a difference of vision, and it's the difference between a healthy religion and a dying religion. This text, sometimes I get discouraged when I think about the state of American religion, but think about what the text itself says, and this is kind of encouraging to me. What happened? Jesus says, you hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath day untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to give it water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound 18 long years, be set free, even on the Sabbath day? And here's what's encouraging. And when he said this, all his opponents were put to shame. And the entire crowd was rejoicing at all the wonderful things he was doing. Sometimes, you know, it's good for us to use our common sense for a change. No matter what we've heard from the tradition, sometimes it's good to prioritize healing and the right-wising of the world over our particular senses of what's right and what's wrong. It's good for this woman to be healed. No matter what the past told people, they recognized in their hearts it was good for the woman to be healed. And, you know, we are often surrounded by dysfunctional forms of religion and dysfunctional institutions and traditions, and it can make the heart sad and the body weary thinking about how many people all around the world are spending so much time and energy pushing agendas that really don't matter all that much when it comes to healing the world. It can be really discouraging for those of us who are working towards a better world. And maybe that's one reason a lot of people don't care to be involved with church as much nowadays. They might look at church and perhaps think the same way that Gandhi thought in his day when he said, "I like your Christ, but I don't like your Christians. They don't look like your Christ." Maybe a lot of people have given up on church because they see churches, maybe even all churches, because they're stereotyping as kind of franchises of a wrecked religion that cares less about the needs of the world and more about the needs of an institution, that cares less about providing alternatives to exploitation and more about providing some pie-in-the-sky insurance policy for the afterlife, and cares less about healing of real people in the real world and the systems that keep them broken, and more about maintaining a comfortable club atmosphere for a chosen few. If that's the case, I can see why people would be upset, and it's discouraging. But this text is not discouraging. This text is hopeful, because the text says, look at the crowds. What are they doing? They are rejoicing. And the good news is this, that people are not dumb. People are not unaware. And people are not unconnected to the divine spark that lies within them some deeper than others. And if there are ears to hear, when people hear the truth being spoken, even when it's not entirely popular, and when they see justice being done, when they see healing being done, even when it's not the status quo, there are crowds of people that rejoice at these wonderful things. There are crowds of people who know it and feel it as good and right because it resonates within them as good and right. And I'd like to think that it resonates at some level within all of us, since all of our hearts are hardwired to beat to the rhythm of God's intentions for the world. People know, even people who don't consider themselves religious, people know when a religion is not wrecked. There are a multitude of people out there who resonate with truth speaking and the healing work of healthy churches and other healthy religious communities. And guess what? For those healthy churches and religious communities who haven't gotten sidetracked and who haven't thrown the baby out with the bathwater and that can speak the truth in love and can do the justice-seeking and reconciling deeds of the risen and living Christ in this world, there are nothing but good days ahead. There's nothing but brighter days ahead. And yes, it's not always easy. And there may be jeering, and there may be criticism of people who are so-called authorities, and there may be crosses along the way. But in the end, there will always be resurrection. May we never be so consumed with our own traditional or personal ideas of right and wrong that we refuse to work for the healing of a hurting person or of a hurting world. And may we never be so concerned with maintaining what has seemed important in the past that we ignore the call of God forward into what might be a very different looking but far better future. Let's pray. Oh God, we pause to accept the fact that we live in a broken world. And sometimes even for us, it's easy to default to a way of doing religion that doesn't call us to speak the truth and doesn't call us to seek the healing you intend. Help us as we try to be living witnesses to the living and risen Christ. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.